This is Hidden Killers Live with Tony Bruschi and Robin Dree.
Here we go.
That's all you can say. Here we go.
I've been talking about this since Friday afternoon when I emailed everybody. Texted Jen. I said, I'm coming at you Monday. And she said, bring it. So here we go. Robin Greek is with me as well. Chief of the Counterintelligence Behavioral Analysis Program, retired FBI and retired FBI, Jennifer Coffendaffer, in the left corner of the ring.
It's round one, no laughing matter, but it is. Right?
We're talking about the Lindsey Clancy case, and we will do it civilly, and we always do, and I love that.
Definitely.
And I think it's important because so many people who have been watching this case in depth, closely, like I know we have, a lot of people watching it passively, but it's created a rift in a lot of relationships and a lot of conversations. And it's okay. It's okay that other people look at things differently and understand things differently. What's not okay is just being like, screw you, I don't want to hear you. Like, let's try to understand a little bit where everyone is coming from. And at the end of the day, you can still disagree. And then you can say, screw you, I don't want to. No, that's not ever a good thing. But to actually, to get there, to understand how one person is going from point A to point B, that's what we're going to try and do today as we break down the Lindsey Clancy case. Your thoughts are welcome in the comments section, Substack and YouTube, wherever you're watching us. The links are in the description. Okay, let's get into this. The defense of the Lindsey Clancy trial has rested. Their final witness was Dr. Philip Resnick, the psychiatrist who helped acquit Andrea Yates. And he told this jury Clancy was psychotic the day she killed her children. The prosecution answered with rebuttal experts of their own, starting with Dr. Avram Mack, who says she retained responsibility. Jennifer Coffendaffer, like I said, she is here with us to help break it down on her perspective. The guilt argument says she never told a doctor about the voice. And that's true. Her own expert admitted it on cross. But nobody in that courtroom is arguing that she was well. The prosecution's official position is mentally ill, but responsible. And Dr. Zeisel testified that a month before the killings, she went to a clinic paranoid, saying her brain was damaged and that she should end herself. Everyone agrees she was sick, as much as the prosecution said it won't be a referendum about mental health. How sick does someone have to be before you say, not responsible? It seems to be an issue here of where is the bars? Where's the goalpost on this? Jan, I'm just going to throw it over to you. Where is the bars on this? I mean, where are you on this, too? I think we all can agree somewhat that she was sick. Maybe not. I don't know.
Oh, I agree she was sick. Look, anybody who can take exercise ban and strangle the life out of their kids five and below is sick. This is the issue for me. And the bar is very simple. I see the goalpost. It's in bright neon. Was she in her mind understanding right from wrong? And could she have stopped herself? It's so simple. In other words, were there bats flying around in her brain and she didn't know where she was and she didn't know what she was doing and she wasn't making any sense. She was incoherent. She was a hot mess up here. No, that's not the answer, but that's my bar.
But that's not what psychosis looks like. What you're describing is not psychosis.
It depends on who you talk to, right? You have half of the people saying that are quote unquote experts saying she was able to determine that. You have Resnick saying no. But listen, I'm saying
psychosis isn't like sitting in the corner with bats flying around your brain.
Oh,
psychosis can look very normal. It's more about where true north is for you, basically, at that moment in time. What I would say, the way I try to understand it, a state of psychosis would be like this. And I'm curious to get your thoughts. A compass. Remember back in the day, compasses? Most of us remember compasses. You can be in an area where your compass reading can be off, where the magnetic pole is screwing up your compass. And you're like, but if you don't know that there's a magnetic pole that's screwing up true north on your compass, and you are not familiar with the environment or what's going on here, you may be thinking you're going north and you may be going southwest, but because that pole, your compass being off, is inaccurate, you don't know that. So you're going to keep following your compass because your compass hasn't screwed you up yet. It's taking you in this direction. You fully believe you're going in the right direction. There's nothing telling you that your compass is off until that pull ends, whatever it may be. And then you're going back, how the hell did I go, 18 miles in this direction when it says I've been going this? And you're horrified. That's how I'm looking at what was going on in her brain that day. It's
an interesting analogy, Tony, but this is where it fails. At the point that you fall off a cliff, at the point that you put your foot in a ravine and lose your balance, at a point at which you do something that is detrimental to somebody else, that's when the wake-up call comes and you're like, no, I'm not going true north. I'm going due south. And she, in this process of murdering her kids, had all sorts of mud puddles and cliffs she was falling off of. And, I'll get into my philosophy on this, but I just want to take what your question is.
Yeah.
This is, have you seen somebody in psychosis? Because I personally have. I'm going to give you examples. Number one, working the job. People who were psychotic based on their drug usage. These people had no, forget about North and South. They didn't even know who they were, what they were doing as they're picking their skin off, as they're, trying to get their methamphetamine fix. One jumped from about a 3-story window, not even a 2-story window. By the way, he did just fine. These people are batshit crazy. Okay, so there's that I've personally seen. I have a relative, sadly, who still very much suffers from psychosis. She thinks the U.S. government is after her. She has pulled out her fillings. She has tinfoil on her walls. She wears tinfoil when she goes to bed. And there's no way to medicate her. There's no way to get her help because she's not a danger to herself or others. She just lives in this state of paranoia. It's really super sad.
Drug-induced psychosis.
That's not drug-induced.
Well, you just were talking about meth use, so that's where I went with.
Oh, I'm so sorry, Toby. The first example.
And then the other one. I mean, it's not postpartum psychosis. So they're not the same sort of.
Cancer. There's so many different types of cancers. Like saying, well, you didn't die of your cancer because you had thyroid cancer. Oh, actually, you would die from that.
It's like saying you have colon cancer, but you didn't get breast cancer.
Psychosis, and this is postpartum, and even postpartum has many different manifestations. I want to also emphasize, these are my interpretations and assessments of what the actual professionals are saying, not me. I am actually synthesizing, and I'll go through when we get to it, my protocol for listening to the professionals with the experience in the area talking about these expert things as testimony, not my conjecture, and just what the experts are saying on this. And the arguments for against it from lay people in the audience like me are moot to me. I'm listening to the experts. I'm listening at Cross. I have watched every single testimony throughout this thing, and I have my criteria for agreeing and disagreeing with things. And there's just nothing on the area when it comes to anything having to do with the postpartum psychosis. It says she didn't have it. She definitely had it from my interpretation and assessment of what the experts have said, including the number one in the world, Resnick. I don't care how old you say he is. I don't care whether, and he did it 3 months after she actually committed it compared to Mac. Okay, 4 months after compared to 3.5 years after Mac and the other Yahoo showed up that have zero experience with postpartum except going back till 2001. He's a generalist. I mean, again, I listened to the entire thing. I am going to go. Don't worry. I'm not having a stroke. The sun went down. It's pretty good, isn't it?
I was a little worried.
Jen, you're sitting in a dark cloud against me. And I also want to, again, I'll get more into this in a second, but for everyone watching, I want everyone to understand before this even started, we all reiterated our love for each other. We're all good friends. We care for each other. And regardless of the outcome of this, I'm not feeling any differently towards Jen after this, but I very specifically said, I am 180% completely opposite of everything she said on this case, absolutely everywhere. But that's why we're here, to understand, so you all can understand where we're coming from. I am on the researcher side. I am on what they're saying. I'm on the preponderance of what the experts are saying on postpartum psychosis. And then I'm looking at the behavior arc. I'm looking at every single family member that knows her through her journey, through her life, from people that wouldn't even, you know, if this was any other human being, wouldn't do this. So when you look at that totality, when you look at the medical totality, when you look at everything you're seeing and presented, I'm like, the preponderance is there. So even people saying, well, anyway, I'll let it rest.
Yeah, I mean, there's so many different sides to this. Let's talk about the planning on this. And a lot of this depends on what you believe of the experts that have testified, their history, their expertise. One of the experts that was brought in was an expert on the Andrea Yates case about the bands. Resnick. Andrea Yates planned to. She waited for her husband to leave, and then she drowned the five children one at a time, methodically, over an hour. A jury heard all of that and said, insanity. Dr. Resnick testified Clancy was following a command voice, same finding made in the Yates case. So if the planning didn't prove sanity for Yates, you know, does it prove it for Clancy? I guess it really depends if you believe Andrea Yates. I mean, I guess I should ask that question because it really qualifies where anyone would go with this. You know, what's your opinion on Andrea Yates, Jen? Was this...
Well, oh, sorry, Tony.
No, yeah.
First of all, one point that I have to get squared away on this whole cancer analogy, I think it's a horrible analogy, and let me tell you why.
I researched it.
If you have cancer, which is this growth and spreading of cells, I don't care whether it's in your pancreas, whether it's in your breast, whether it's in your brain, that it has the same mechanism of injury, mechanism of taking over. It just starts in a different place. And so when it comes to psychosis, I will say it is analogous in this way. You guys are trying to say it's not analogous because you're trying to say it's because the body part. No, in my opinion, cancer is cancer. Still the recreation of cells over and over that kills you. And psychosis, it's psychosis, whether it started in one way or the other, it still means you are psychotic and have no control of your brain.
But it presents, that's not what psychosis also means. Psychosis doesn't mean having no control over your body.
But cancer also, the cells, some cancers are more aggressive, some cancers are less aggressive. Some will kill you in a couple of weeks or days, some will kill you after 10 years.
The point is, and I feel about this is we all have experiences with various types of people. Sometimes you have people that have been in various types of psychosis, this or that, but it's like, that's not them. That's not who we're talking about over here. And it's not the same thing. I mean, because unless it's postpartum psychosis and we're talking about like Andrea Yates, where it comes very close, very same scenario. I don't think it's a fair analogy to talk about someone in psychosis because of meth use or because of underlying ongoing medical condition that torments them daily. You know, her falling in and out of psychosis here seemed to be fairly rare or if to ever, other than when this occurred. So they're just fundamentally different things. It's not the same sort of thing. So to say this person had it over here, great, but what does it have to do with this? That's kind of where I'm looking at, because it's easy to jump over to go, well, I saw it present this way, so that must mean it presents that way over here. It doesn't. It just doesn't. So I think that's important to understand, you know, the case, to understand where she was and how she was interpreting these things. We can all agree it's horrible, but is it the same as someone who's picking their skin away because they're in a psychotic state that's drug-induced? It's not. There's a theory that she's a sociopath. She even Googled whether sociopaths can be treated. But a sociopath caught for murder fakes crazy to escape punishment. That's the playbook. Resnick testified the testing showed the opposite, no faking. And she downplayed her own symptoms as well. She wasn't trying to, I'm really crazy, let me live this up more. If she was faking, I mean, there's tests for this. There's a Rorschach test. If she was faking, why was she downplaying symptoms instead of playing them up? Wouldn't that be the opposite of what one would be doing if they're trying to fake this?
Okay, sorry. Can I go back, though, to your question on Andrea Yates?
Yeah. And then
get to this one. So on Andrea Yates, it's very important to understand that there were two trials, one in 2002 and one in 2006. Yeah. I was in Texas at that time. Many of us lived through this. My co-worker, Cindy Rosenthal, her husband, Chuck Rosenthal, was the one in charge of that trial.
Okay.
And so very much, I don't know if I want to say insider knowledge, but certainly knowledge of a lot of things that happened in that trial and what was admitted, what was not, what was deemed way too prejudicial. Of course, what happened with their expert sort of fantasizing about this law and order thing that got that thrown out. But it's very critical to point out that Resnick was the defense on both sides, and he didn't sway or have, you know, the influence he hoped to have in the first trial. They took the facts and so forth in the first trial and convicted her. So she was convicted. It got overturned because of one of the experts, their recollection about a law and order episode that didn't even exist.
Right.
It was in the making, by the way, and it did get made later. But my point on this is this. We get two different juries, everyone. Two different juries.
That's why it's tough.
And to say that, I mean, it's just too different, right? So it doesn't surprise me at all that there were two different outcomes. When you ask about Andrea Yates, ever since she was a teen, had serious mental issues, everyone. Please go back and research. She was bulimic. She was suicidal. She had so many issues before she ever got married and had kids. And boy, let me tell you, once she got married and had kids, it even went off the rails. She was schizophrenic. She was hospitalized. She was a hot mess of mental illness. Horrible. We can never, ever compare the two. When I compare them, it's to show how you can't compare them. Their backgrounds are completely different. If Lindsey Clancy had Andrea Yates's diagnoses of bipolar, of schizophrenia, of suicide, of everything she had, I would have likely a different view on this case.
But that does.
But you just, but Jen, you just said it. You said Andrea Yates, and I agree. Andrea Yates had a lifetime of issues. Her first suicide attempt came after her third child, and so she was diagnosed, actually attempted to be diagnosed for an extremely long time throughout her life, which was not the case because it manifested differently in the post. So she had stuff that was going on prior to being postpartum, and then postpartum kicked in and threw a lot of kerosene on it with Yates. And I never compared it to Yates until other people compared it to Yates. And I was trying to show comparisons and actually a timeline when certain things were happening with Yates at the same birth times that were happening in Lindsey Clancy as well. In other words, the first suicide ideation happened around the birth, around the same type of child. It wasn't on the first one for Yates. It was on the third. And for Lindsey, same thing. It happened later on. So all I was doing was there's more comparisons that you can draw between the two than not.
So Jen, she does have, I mean, it may not be as long of a path as Yates did, but there certainly is, you know, in the very least in the months leading up. My conjecture is she's probably been undiagnosed bipolar for a long time. But in the months leading up, diagnosed incorrectly, I mean, that happens, and it certainly appears to have been what happened here, getting the wrong types of medication. So she was diagnosed incorrectly with generalized anxiety and anxiety and depression, basically, and being treated for that with drugs that interact basically the opposite of what you want if you actually have bipolar. It works against you, and that's what was going on with her system. The S ideation, that's all there. That she did have that. So, I mean, I guess she did have those qualifying things you were just talking about, Jen, leading up to the actual event.
Not diagnosed mental illness. Look, she was
struggling. It was mental illness. It was depression and anxiety. It just wasn't bipolar.
And back to your point about these meds, this is critical to understand that 4 years later, 3 years later, 4 months later, if you look at the list of the different meds she was on per the testimony, oh my God, it's the same medications except for Wellbutrin, was added in. Other than that, it's still Seroquel. It's still a benzodiazepine. It's still a stabilizer. It's when I saw the list, I'm like, okay, that's exactly what they had given her anyway. Now, I don't know about the exact dosages. They didn't get into all of that.
Well, it's up and down, and it's on this, it's off that.
I mean, it's so important to understand what was in her body at the time. And all it was dosages that were therapeutic.
But nobody's arguing toxicity.
I'm just saying everybody is. Everybody's saying,
it's incorrectly being argued because that's not the point.
That's very rare. But let's go back to the original question that we're talking about, though, is the malingering aspect of it, her faking it and over-exaggerating. But every single expert that testified, got it right here, not one of the medical experts, not one person at Room said at any point, was she faking? Was she exaggerating? Matter of fact, the test that she took says that she underreported things because she was an exaggerator. And so the thought process that she faked it, that she wasn't truthful, every single expert, both from the prosecution and defense, said nope, she was truthful throughout, no malingering whatsoever.
Okay, you ready, Robin? I can ask you something 4 years from now, 3 years from now, 4 months from now. It is unrelated to how she was at that time. Period. End of story. When I'm interviewing
everyone in her life, also agreed. So you're saying that you are the one individual in her entire world that says she's lying.
When I interview somebody, if they are under all of this medication and they're talking about self-serving statements, they've got this million gazillion dollar lawsuit open and everything else. Self-serving. The later ones, absolutely, Tony.
But Jen, you just made an argument that you're right and everyone that testified is wrong.
I'm not making a statement that I'm right or wrong. I'm making the statement that I do not put credence in a psychiatrist, a paid psychiatrist. Not that I don't think they are very good in their field. They are obvious experts. It was such an education for me, for sure, and I'm sure for lots of people, to just hear about postpartum psychosis, to hear about drug interactions, to hear about, generally speaking, it was very interesting testimony by everybody. But they don't know Lindsay Clancy. They sure as hell don't know her from that moment that she made those
her
decisions.
Her family does.
But
her
friends
do. Her family wasn't even interviewed. They did. The one.
I meant for her life. Through all the people
didn't
testifying.
Even talk to her husband.
All the people testifying didn't see it. And when it comes to congruence, so here's how my behavior team worked. And this is where my lifetime in the Bureau works, is that when we did a behavioral assessment, we assessed people for truth, veracity, and congruence and all these things. So we made the behavioral observations. Then my operational psychs, matter of fact, one of them is Dr. Chris Mahandy out on the West Coast, Dr. Reed Malloy. We had some of the best in the world that tested to make sure our observations were congruent with science. And so my 23 years of reps with the FBI of doing these assessments, when I was looking, I do my observation assessment. And so I saw nothing but congruency on the witness stand from her and nothing but congruency and everything. And we see, again, we don't know her, you're right, in those moments. But when you take the preponderance of what the experts are saying, what they tested for, you take what I'm witnessing in the courtroom, and then you take what the people in her life are saying, which are the best indicators for anyone, are the people in your life. And there is not one blip that she has ever had anything of exaggeration. In other words, there's not one report anywhere that says she's a liar, she's an exaggerator. There's nothing. So this would be the very first time in her entire life that she did that. And that's what makes
what
it incongruent.
She told everybody, I want to harm the kids. And nobody listened to her. She told her mother that. She told her father that. So by this premise,
she was truthful.
She knew. She is the most responsible for this, obviously.
Absolutely. And the planning happens in psychosis. That's what Dr. Resnick described very, very well. It's not just command hallucin. I know you don't like Dr. Resnick now.
No.
But you did on Yates because he helped convict Yates.
No, he helped get her off. I mean, he didn't help convict.
I know. He helped defend her because of the
psychotic
rape. One time,
yes. One time, no. One time the jury bought it. One time the jury didn't.
A world-renowned expert on it.
On which jury you're looking at.
So who would you listen to on the stand if not Yates, if not Resnick?
Okay. In this situation, I would listen to anyone, Resnick, any of them. Mac, if they would have interviewed her, and I understand all the legal issues involved in this and how long it takes. I totally get it, how long it takes to get the expert on board and blah, blah, blah. What I'm saying is I would listen to the people who diagnosed her, who met with her at in and around the time of the murders. I can't go 4 months later. No possible way, and medicated, and talked for a whopping 3 hours. I've conducted witness interviews of a loose witness, in other words, that wasn't the one that hinged on whether the case was going to result in a conviction or not, for more than 3 hours. I mean, gang investigations, 5 hours, multiple times, 10-hour interviews to get information. You're going to hinge your decision on this case, Robin, based on a 3-hour interview to a medicated individual 4 months later by an 88-year-old who, by the way, forgot where he interviewed her.
I'm going to base it on him. I'm going to base it on all the other testimony. I'm basing it on my own observations. I'm basing it on every single person in that courtroom that has been testifying. I watched it. I evaluated it. I assessed it. And again, it doesn't matter what I think anyway. It's just what the jury's going to get, which I think is going to be on the jury.
At the same point, Jen, too, the expert for the state that came in at the end here, Mac, didn't talk to her for like 3 years or after. And again, a very short interview. So I'd put about the same sort of weight there too. I mean, even worse because it's so far out, you know, years later. What was it like 3 years ago at the worst moments of your life? Like, yeah, I mean, you're not going to get the most accurate either way. But overwhelmingly, I would say, yeah, I mean, the experts here, you know, that have testified, I think have really laid out, how this works, how psychosis works, and folks who've lived that world as their career path, working with people who are suffering from it. I don't know, it's been very compelling. Your thoughts in the comments section on Substack and YouTube as we continue this conversation. Deep breath,
it's still
everybody.
A conversation, which is good.
It's good. We have one more segment on
you
Lindsay,
know I
and
love
then.
You.
And then we're going to talk about the latest in the Nolan Wells case. The guilt side of this case isn't attacking the evidence so much anymore. It's attacking the witnesses. The doctor's too old. The chaplain wasn't ordained. Even Clancy's face in the courtroom is getting entered as evidence. Every one of those attacks has a problem, and we're going to be going through some of them that have been being brought to light on the internet. The knock on Resnick is that he's 88 and only saw her for a few hours, 4 months after the killings. Okay. Dr. Mack saw her for the first time in April of this year, 3 years after. That's not Mac's fault. The state's experts aren't allowed until the insanity defense is filed. But it's still 3 years. Resnick got there in 4 months. Mac got there in 3 years. Is there more reliability to the other, Jen?
I don't have reliability on any of them. And that's why in all of these trials, expert testimony, sometimes it's not even allowed because they say, they're concerned about the jurors not following the evidence and instead taking the word of experts. I've seen it happen. It happens all the time. In this case, they are allowing it, but the judge has made it critically clear. These experts have no more weight on their testimony than anyone else. Mm-hmm. So there's zero more weight. So when each juror and all of us, we have to take into account each person who testified. Did they make sense? Was it congruent with the time of what happened? How long did they interview? What was the condition of the person they interviewed? You have to look at the totality. For me, the totality, when you're talking about a case that is this important, I am not basing it on what they had to say. I'm basing it on the facts before us, period. And that does mean, though, to Robin's point, what the husband said, what the mother said, what the mother-in-law said, what witnesses said, what the nanny said. So I base it on all of that, and the experts just X each other out. That's my opinion.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because you can have, I mean, that's when we're going through this case, I was going through it earlier today. It's like, okay, well, one side says this, and now the next expert says this and disagrees. And who's being paid for who and where side? It's how it always works.
You know, and there, I keep coming back to this one point we actually do have in common on this and where I do agree, and that is the premeditation side. I saw premeditation, you know, for a period of time before. It's just what we are disagreeing on is what you can and
what does it mean
do. Right, it's like for me, from what I'm understanding from the experts, is that you can actually plan in psychosis, you can actually plan and be premeditated in doing the horrendous things she did to her kids in psychosis. And so that's where it really comes down to, is like I think half the, you know, large number of people don't believe she's in a psychotic postpartum state, and other people do. And that's because, again, there's no debating she killed her kids. There's no debating she's mentally ill. What's, I think the real debate is, was she in postpartum psychosis when she premeditated the killing of her kids? And again, that's what I think it comes down to ultimately. And again, it doesn't matter what us here thinks. We can do all the research out here we want, but again, it's what the jury is getting, is what their impressions are. It's how it's being presented in the courtroom. It's Reddington's presentation. It's the prosecution's presentation. It's what's working, not working. And that's where, you know, we've got our man Bob Mata on the scene in the courtroom, which we keep seeing every time they pan to the audience. So it's going to come down to that jury. And that's why these cases are debated like this, because they're exceptionally rough and they're also very rare. Because like Jen said at the very beginning, we don't know ourselves what was exactly in her mind. Everyone's just trying to figure it out because no one's believing her that she said, "I heard these voices." Fair. She's the one on trial.
Jen, let's talk about what's going through a lot of people's minds, things that have absolutely nothing to do with the case directly, but have somehow made it to be part of people's opinions. It's not just the camps of we think she's responsible or not. It's, we think it's somebody else entirely that some people have gone to, which is not even up for debate. Like, she's admitted to doing this. There's no, like, back in the land of reality where we can certainly disagree about was she mentally there to be conscious of it. But this whole other camp is Patrick did it. And God knows how weird those stories get. Some have him going to such extremes where he's literally, you know, there with a voice changing device and being the voice of God to her, telling her that she needs to do that. I mean, it gets quite insane. What's your reaction to all of that and that world that has emerged out of this? Because I know you've seen tweets back at you in your feed from the opinions you've expressed that go way off base from your opinion. And it's not my, it's like a whole other category out there.
It is a whole nother category. And I think it's induced because this is so insane to think that some voice told her to kill her three kids. And like I always say, well, did they also say, call your husband and make sure he's away? Did they say to Google? Did they particularly say to use the exercise bands? And when one exercise band maybe wasn't tight enough, move to the next exercise band and do them one by one. And by the way, in between, order Pedialax and talk and make phone calls. I mean, what did these voices really do, right? So when you start getting in what I think is absolute conjecture and out there, now you have people springboard off that and say, oh, well, if it's the mystical voice, what if it was Patrick's? What if Patrick really did it? And they try to infuse really ridiculous notions that don't line up with the evidence to comport with this thought. But that's what everybody else is doing too with the psychosis theory, because they're taking facts that don't comport with somebody in psychosis, which I just named, to the voice made me do it. The voice that, by the way, was never mentioned, even though she mentioned killing her kid or hurting her kids, not killing, harming her kids, to both her parents, that the voices never came in until after.
Welcome to psychosis.
She was only psychotic at the time. By the way, oh,
that's how that works.
Errands, and now I'm going psychotic.
Yeah, I mean, Jen, that's just kind of how that works. I mean, you can be in that state.
You just don't like the definition of psychosis.
Well, I mean,
you don't agree with it.
It's like what you're describing is like, yeah, that's how. I mean, there's people who are in a psychotic state that think they're being watched, that there's hidden cameras everywhere, and they could sit here and conduct their normal day. You know, there are cameras everywhere. Oh shit.
Well, the good thing, we all do agree that we think the ideas of Patrick doing this are really ludicrous. So there you go. There's another area we do agree on, is that those are, you know, you have nutters and then you have supreme ultra nutters, and those are ones.
You were talking about The Voice. There's a theory that The Voice was invented for her malpractice lawsuit. The lawsuit was filed in January 26. The chaplain says Clancy told her about The Voice in the first week. Still intubated. And she described the voice to Mac too. Male, laughing, telling her it was her last chance. She told the prosecution's own doctor about The Voice. Why would a faker, I guess, do that? I mean, and then also the chaplain saying that, yeah, she told me about it early on too. So, you know, it was there from early on before anybody's like lining up attorneys to sue anybody.
It's still after the act, not before the act. Tony, have you ever watched Harry Potter?
Actually, no.
Oh, wow.
Ever.
Have you, Robin?
Yeah, I've read all the books and watched it, yeah.
Okay. She was literally Professor Umbridge. It was like unbelievable for those in the audience. The chaplain, in my opinion, look, you know it. 200 visits at a hospital she wasn't even assigned to. She absolutely wrote out, in my opinion, scripted what she was going to say. The verbiage she has is absolutely out there. Her, you know, and turning, no, I don't believe the chaplain, but this is the biggest reason the fact pattern tells me it's not the chaplain. 200 plus visits. She wrote all of these notes, and the jury's going to get all of this. All of these perfect notes, even quoted her. Never once touched on the alleged, because that's what she says, alleged voice. Never, ever mentions that. But, you know, copious notes on everything else. That was one of the most unbelievable performative witnesses I've ever seen. That's my
favorite. So I didn't see her as performative. I saw her as definitely different. There's no doubt. Her presentation was different. Her, you know, I'm with you, though. Her... And she explained it well, and they got her on cross. You know, I get the reasons why she didn't write it down, and it definitely hurt her. Not writing down, you know, writing down a few quotes and not writing down those big ones, I'm with you. That hurt her credibility for hearing those voices. But I found the consistency of her to be up there just because she did see Lindsay for a amount of time. But, you know, but I... When I took that one data, like if she stood alone, if she was the only one that said anything about the voices, I'm like, that's pretty sketchy. But again, it's one more data point of what was presented, because I'm with you. Her not writing it down, even though she's not required to write it down. She said, I'm not one of these mental health professionals. I'm not required to do this. I do this for my own note-taking capabilities and refresh my memory. So all those reasons, they made complete sense. But at the same time, if you would hope that given what actually transpired, she'd have that awareness enough, I better write this shit down because that's a big one. So I'm with you on that. I won't disagree. It would have been helpful if she did.
There's a lot in this case.
I don't think it happened. That's why she did.
Maybe.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, in the world of maybe.
There's a lot where it's like, maybe this should have been done differently. Maybe this should have done better. Maybe you shouldn't have gone out and gotten takeout when your wife has said these horrible things that are, you know, going through her mind. I get it. But, you know, at the end of the day, there's a lot of things you look back on and go, at that moment, I wasn't thinking that way. For those of everybody who was caught in the ether of Lindsay Clancy.
Yeah, because I'm sorry, let me add one more thing. You know, let's reverse it for a second. You know, just for understanding why she wouldn't do that. So here you are, you're a chaplain. You were a professional. She's a vice president. I think she's, again, everyone that's much more fact and detail oriented. I don't have all my notes in front of me. She's an executive at a VP level for some company for, I think she said, 10 or 15 years before she decided to move on to be a chaplain. And so she, from what I gathered from her testimony and when they're going through her credentials, that she wanted to make these connections. She wanted, and I think a lot of it was volunteer time she did too in there. So I saw someone who's extremely empathetic, trying to make a difference in people that were hurting, and that's her role as a chaplain in these hospitals when she went in there and was touching base not just with Lindsay, but all these patients that were in there. That was her role. She saw herself as a humanitarian. I don't think at the top of her mind when she's doing these sorts of things that she'd be called to testify at this level. If you reverse and you put yourself in that situation, would you really be thinking that? Because she's not a medical professional, she doesn't have to chart anything she does, and so it would be a major blip of something she would have had to have done that she's never done before. That's why I'm reasonably saying it would have been better if she had, but yeah. I understand why she didn't.
Yeah.
I think the whole thing was a blip. The only reason the defense put her on was for that one reason.
Sure.
She really should have never been called, to be honest with you, because that wasn't her job. But because
she's
willing to say that, and this is the quote, right, that Lindsay alluded to a voice and alluded, she said it each time, alluded to him. What does that even mean?
No, she said what the voice actually specifically said.
Oh, if you look at it, though, it's alluded. She each time prefaced what was alluded. And to me, she was, I didn't buy anything she said. And I think she wanted to be on TV.
You know what really helped for me with her was when Resnick came in and did a deeper dive and understanding of what that actually, so what the chaplain was saying, and what she said was that the first thing that Lindsay said was, and again, if I misquote it, I apologize, my children are safe now. And then when Resnick came in and explained what Lindsay said, the voice said to her 4 months later, was that the voice said the only way for your children, yeah, look it up if you can, Jen, the only way for your children to be safe is for you to kill them and then to take care of yourself as well. And so her mental state was that in order for my children, which is her main motivation in life, which is that life arc through all the other testimony, was her children's safety and well-being. The command voice comes in there. And then Resnick took it that next level from his diagnosis, was that it wasn't just a voice, but in some cases of postpartum psychosis, they're actually physically unable to stop from doing what they're doing from that command voice. And so that's what, so when I put those two together, I was like, oh, now I understand why she used that wording because of this. And so again, never just one data point. That's what I sucked it in from both.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot there. And at the end of the day, as much as, you know, I mean, I think, you know, everybody's argument, you know, holds, it's very complicated. The facts are as we understand them at the end of the day. None of us know what the hell was going on in her mind. A jury of her peers also don't know what was going on in her mind. Very quickly, because I want to get onto Nolan Wells. I don't want to go over this 1,000 ways. Where do you think it lands, Jen? Because this might be the last time we're on the air before there is a verdict. Yeah. Do you think guilty, not guilty, hung jury? Where do you think it goes?
With this? Most likely a hung jury.
Yeah.
But if I had to lean one way or the other, I think she will be found not guilty by reason of insanity. Whether I agree with it or not.
Sure. That's where you think it lands. Robin?
Yeah, I agree with Jen on this. I see, look, another point. I think it's probably going to be hung. Yeah. Just because, again, when you look at the makeup of what they said the jury's made up of, you had more women on there than men. But again, it's hard to tell. We're not in that courtroom. But I'm agreeing with Jen just from public sentiment what we're seeing. It's leaning more towards the Lindsay side right now in public sentiment, which if I, but again,
doesn't I'm, mean I'm, you I'm, get a unanimous jury, though. I think we're going to end up with a hung jury as well. I don't see any way this ever gets tried where you get a unanimous jury. I just don't.
It's rough.
I hope it's not guilty by reason of insanity, but I don't know. I don't know that you're going to get everybody there.
Not criminally responsible, I think.
Yeah, criminally responsible. Yeah, I just don't know. But fascinating discussion. Your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube. We'd love for you to weigh in. Let's go over to another case that is still making headlines because, well, it's still out there in the ether. And one of the key reasons it's still out there in the ether is because a certain cell phone still hasn't been looked at. Nolan Wells. phone, the key piece of evidence that could settle the loudest claim in this case, that somebody wiped it, that something went on. And now we're, what, 8 weeks, 7 weeks after he died? No agency has examined it. The family says it's ready. The DA says she can't discuss it. And the phone has been sitting as of this morning, as of this recording. I don't know if it's gone anywhere yet, but hopefully it goes somewhere soon. Jen Coffendaffer, retired FBI special agent, with myself and Robin Drake, retired FBI special agent, chief of the Counterintelligence Behavioral Analysis Program. The hell? I mean,
it's a good one.
What the hell? I was kind of shocked. I was just trying to do an update on this case the other day. Like, oh, what's new? I haven't heard anything. And like, oh, the phone hasn't gone anywhere yet. Jen, I mean, from an investigative criminal standpoint, how the hell is that even a possibility this many weeks into this, unless it's not being looked at as a criminal investigation?
Well, they've got to look at the phone.
Yeah,
going on. This is kind of a no-brainer. It needs to be analyzed to make sure nothing has been erased. It needs to be looked at to see what communications took place. It also needs to be looked at to see the last time it was held, touched. Like, when did he check in? When did
Everything.
Everything needs to be looked at, and it's a no-brainer. It's going to have to be reviewed.
So, Jen, and we talked about this with Eric Faddis the other day, and now this is an area I listen to a lot because you had a lot of reps in this area when it comes to data collection and investigative techniques like this. What do you think happens? So, even at this point, so they get the phone, and but the family's had it for so long. How can they use that or not use it? I mean, do you think it'll stand up under scrutiny by the defense or the prosecution? I mean, it seems like
how
a really
do they
tainted,
still have it?
Well, first of all, it's a really tainted piece of evidence to me. It's like leaving, to me, when you have a phone like that in the hands of the family for so long, it's as if you have the crime scene and you left the tape down. You let everyone traipse through it all the time because everyone has access to it.
I tell you, though, the beauty of digital evidence is if anything was done after the fact, it's going to have those timestamps.
Yeah, that's true.
And so from that standpoint, that's why your crime scene's kind of protected. It's sort of like if you have a crime scene like you just discussed and everybody's trampling through it, but I've got videotape all over the place showing who's trampling.
Good analogy, yeah. So
I really like the fact that it was always my favorite piece of evidence, always the one that at least I would ask the prosecutor, hey, listen, for our cool charts we're going to put up and everything, let's do it last, because the juries eat it up. And then in talking to juries afterwards, they will tell you, you know, digital evidence has no ambition. It has no, it's just,
it's there. It just is.
Yeah. It just is.
It's so ones and zeros. It'll answer questions. Yeah. No matter what you want it to be. Okay. So I'm trying to wrap my mind around any other investigation where a critical piece of evidence just sits in the hands of the people who originally had it for all of this time. That's the part I'm having a hard time, because I'm like, well, where's the incentive here to not have this thing examined? And I mean, it really could benefit both sides depending on what's on it. Is this both sides not wanting to open Pandora's box? Because on one side, you got the claims that Snapchat was deleted and this and that. And well, open up the phone. Let's find out. Let's get the info from Snapchat. Let's find out what that says. Was anything actually deleted? If it's no, well, then that whole people went in and messed with the phone theory is all bullshit. And then all the vitriol on top of that doesn't make any sense because it's based on nothing. Or we open the phone and it shows a lot of deleted shit. And it shows information that doesn't look so lovely. Then the whole, well, this is all an overreaction over there, that doesn't look good. Both sides really, you know, could stand to look pretty shitty on this, depending on what the phone reveals. One side is the law. One side has subpoena authority, has authority to go in and actually just take the damn evidence and look at it. Why haven't any of those levers been pulled? Why this is, I don't know. I'm kind of baffled by this whole thing of just, how has this been sitting here for this long and that lever hasn't been pulled? I get the patience in the first week or two, maybe. We're going to do this together, so it's all on the up and up. We certainly want transparency, but at some point, we're going to get to the answers here. We got to kind of look at the evidence.
Well, from the prosecution side, they want this phone. I think it's going to prove their point. Nothing was erased. There's nothing nefarious that went on. And I think they really want to get the phone analyzed. Remember, though, the parents came out and this side, Crump, he came out and they said, listen, we've got our own digital experts and they're going to look at it and what they need to do. So you've got that side of it. Who did they hire? Has the phone been looked at by them? It's kind of this nebulous. I'm not sure what the answer is. And then, of course, it's got to be given over. The government doesn't want to do a subpoena in this case, in my opinion, or a warrant, because they want the family to cooperate. They want to do what we call a consent search, where they sign it over. We'll see, though. I mean, I am surprised that it hasn't been reviewed by the government, but it will be.
You know, on the conjecture side, do we know if the families sent it out for private investigator to do it? Because that's my question is, so if the family then did hire someone and they have their own forensic people analyzing the phone, how's that work? You know, if you're going to use it then for prosecution, will the prosecution use the same people that did it? I mean, that's kind of weird to me.
Yeah, no matter what, the prosecution will use their people.
Right.
They're going to use whether they go with the FBI. The FBI is involved in this, and I think they're involved in this just for this reason.
Yeah.
So I think that they will go to an FBI expert that will.
So what happens to then? So say that the family comes up with different stuff on that phone, or they have a different theory or a different assessment of it. Will they include that, not include? Will defense include it? It looks like the SOI, it looks really messy when you do stuff like this.
Yeah, you know, the experts can battle it out, but at the end of the day, like we just talked about,
it is what it is.
Objective evidence. There's zero subjectivity to it, unless you start making things up about a search that happened at 2:28 in the morning, like what happened in Reed's case. But typically speaking, you're going to have, you know, very competent experts, and they should agree, kind of like with the autopsy.
Right.
Remember how in the autopsy, they really kind of agreed?
Yeah.
We
don't have the state's, you know, results yet, and that's sitting there for the grand jury. I guess my question is, you know, there's talk that there's going to be a grand jury. Maybe there is a grand jury. I mean, that can take some time, obviously, and they want to present the phone evidence to the grand jury. Where is that at right now, Jen? In your opinion, is there a grand jury that's been convened? We don't know for sure. It's all secretive. But at this point, what does your experience tell you?
Yeah, it's been convened and they're slowly processing and listening to all the evidence. I think one thing that can be confusing is that a grand jury sits there, say, for 8 or 12 hours straight, like trial, and listens to all of this. It's typically not how it works. Typically how it works is you will have one or two witnesses slated for a particular day, and that grand jury will hear from those one or two witnesses, and then that's it. And then the next week, they'll come in on their designated day, Wednesday from 10 to noon, whatever their time frame is, and they'll get two more witnesses. So the process is usually a lot longer than you might think, because it's not like trial.
You know, you've done a lot of these, and basically from the tempo that we're seeing or not seeing and all the behavior tells we're seeing from the outside looking in, are you thinking this is going someplace yet, or you don't think it's going someplace, or it's still too early to tell?
Well, I'm judging this opinion, Robin, in large part based on the interviews I've seen of the kids,
right,
of the kids that were on the boat and what they say happened and everything, in huge part of this, right?
Right.
And also all the factors we know. And Tony, you're right. We don't have the autopsy results back. But if you recall very early on, which upset a lot of people, he alluded to the fact that there's nothing to show foul play.
Right.
And that was based on that autopsy, because I've mentioned this, that right when you, as an investigator, you're in there with the ME, they already know, you know, what's going on very early on, what the ME is going to say. So I think this is going to be an accident. I really do. But I think the grand jury will continue to look at it and probably come to that same conclusion.
How long do you think they'll wait I guess they'll just wait till the digital evidence does come in from the analysis, if they do eventually get it, and that'll be the final thing that'll close it out, do you think? Or it'll be the final thing that kind of tips it over to do some sort of prosecution against someone, because then they have to identify who they think did something?
Well, I don't think the digital analysis will be as important in this case. I think it's going to be witness interviews. I think will be very important. You know, did somebody see, you know, a fight? Did somebody see anything that lends itself to the belief that, you know, his friends murdered him?
And do you think we'd have any wobbles in that area right now if there was some testimony that was going to lend to that? Because we haven't seen any, and there are a lot of people who are present for that. You would think that, you know, social media would have some sort of leakage coming on and off on that.
Yeah, I like the word wobble. We don't see any Weebles wobbling, nothing. Yeah. It seems
no wobbles, yes.
In this case. So I just don't think it's there. But because of the infused racist, you know, undertones, they've just got to do it with the grand jury. In other words, look at it.
The Congressional Black Caucus asked the DOJ for a federal review. The NAACP joined the family's legal team, and Al Sharpton has said everything on the phone was erased. Again, a lot of conjecture, a lot of claims being made on evidence that hasn't really been looked at yet. The goal is getting to the truth here. If the family and the local authorities haven't figured their shit out enough yet to get this phone reviewed in a way that's acceptable to both parties, maybe there should be some sort of federal intervention here, since these two parties can't seem to figure this out yet. Not necessarily that needs to go to a level of a murder investigation, but like, guys, we got to take care of this. This we need to actually look at this. What does this look like? Is there anything that should be done or can be done? Or do we just rely on them to eventually get their shit together and take a look at this device?
Well, I'm going to call a spade here.
Yeah.
I mean, part of the reason that Sharpton and, you know, Crump and all these people keep ginning up all of this is because the money keeps pouring in.
It makes them money. I know. I agree.
Yeah. And the more you can throw out there, oh, now we need a federal investigation. You know, Crump is a licensed practitioner of law. He should know there is no chance that there is FBI venue here. And so it's the FBI is never, in my opinion, going to get involved. Shoot, they're not even involved other than peripherally and as a partner, not a lead on the Nancy Guthrie case. And that case, you could argue, has venue. You know, they're just, that's such puffery to
me. It's grandstanding, yeah.
Yeah.
It's grandstanding.
Yeah. So, I mean, there's nothing to, I mean, again, I get that there's that move by stating that is grandstanding, but at the same point, nothing is happening. So it's like, well, somebody's got to kick this down the road a little bit to get somewhere. But, you know, who's that going to be? I don't know the answer to yet, but still no real answers here in this case. We'll see where this goes. I mean, your best guess, Jen, I mean, how long till we determine if a grand jury comes back with a true bill or not here on if this goes anywhere?
Well, you know, if you look at the photos from the beach that day, there were hundreds of people there.
Yeah.
That means there are hundreds of people to interview.
True.
There's also a lot of video that could exist and photographs that could exist. There's the digital phone we just talked about that seemingly still hasn't been analyzed. It's going to be weeks, if not months.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, just think how long it's taking to get through the ring cams in the neighborhood surrounding Nancy Guthrie. We're still hearing, oh, and by the way, there's thousands of more videos we haven't looked at. Oh, really? On a beach with hundreds or thousands of kids and then trying to decipher who's in what shot and all of the evidence that's been turned in from people not knowing what they have. That's a lot. That is a lot to get through.
So, and it does take humans to do that. All right. Your thoughts in the comments section on Substack and YouTube. We'd love for you to weigh in and give us your thoughts there. That's going to wrap it up. All right. We all survived. Until next time.
Good day.
It was yes. Good day. Break the Case. Jennifer Coffendaffer. Go check it out. YouTube, wherever you get podcasts. Robin Drake's latest book. It is this. It's Not All About Me. It's available wherever you get books and on Amazon. Leave a review there. Until next time, for Jen, for Robin, for Todd, I'm Tony. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Brewski and the Hidden Killers podcast.